4 hours in four-wheel drive and studded snow tires. It was actually kind of adventurous, kind of fun.
Okay, I'm going to call this meeting, this February 10th, 2014 meeting of the Senate Energy, the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee to order. Welcome everyone who's here. Thank you for braving the great thaw to get here. Hope you had a fun weekend and get to cabin crazy. And if you did, you've come to the right place. We have people on the phone for one of the bills that we're going to be hearing today, but we have a couple of legislators who need to speak to another bill, and so we're going to put that bill first just for the purpose of getting their testimony. Before we do that, just a couple of announcements. You might have noticed that the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1585, which modified requirements for mining using motorized dredge equipment, a.k.a. suction dredge mining, was canceled at the request of the sponsors earlier today. So if you came to speak to that bill, Senator Boquist, who is one of the sponsors of it, would be happy to meet with you to talk about it up in his office. He's going to be available for the next half hour or so. So please feel free to do that. The sponsors are hoping to work on this issue over the interim, and they would welcome your feedback. Also, I want you to know that we have work sessions scheduled for Senate Bill 1511 and 1512. If you're here for those bills will not be worked today. We still have some more work on them that needs to be done, waiting for amendments, and so those will have their work session on Wednesday. Okay. And maybe I'll go ahead and just carry them over now. Should
Perfect.
I do that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm going to do that formally now, colleagues. I'm going to formally open the work session on Senate Bill 1511, for the purpose of carrying it over.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now I've closed the work session on Senate Bill 1511, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 1512, again for the purpose of carrying it over to Wednesday, I will close that work session. And now I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1584, which allows the State Department of Agriculture to issue a person permit for keeping of qualifying exotic animals. This terminology may be familiar to many of you from the 2009 session, a problem has arisen that there is an attempt to deal with. Senator Olson, do you want to make some opening remarks about this?
Well, not really. For the time being, I'd like to have Senator Roblin and Representative Barton come and speak. Their time is...
All right. Then it's my honor to call up the good senators, Senator Roblin and Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and rest of the committee. For the record, my name is Arnie Roblin. I am a senator from District 5. I'm here because in 2009 I carried the exotic bills that you mentioned earlier on the floor in the House. There were a couple of us that felt this bill was important. Senator Boquist and I at the time worked, and Senator Hass actually in the Senate was this, I believe, as well. And when Senator Olson earlier this year came and talked to me and asked, would I consider looking and opening this, actually not opening, he had a bill that he wanted to produce because of an article that had been in the paper about a lynx in Oregon and a veteran who had that animal and had it for many, many years. And I was a little concerned about opening a bill which I think is doing the right thing with regard to exotic animals. I asked him if he would be willing to sit down. We could have a meeting with the Ag Department, and they brought the veterinarian and also Fish and Wildlife, because as you may have remembered, there was also an issue at the time around the same time with a deer called Snowball. And I didn't want those kind of issues coming back to haunt the legislature or the state of Oregon. And I thought we had done a good job in 2009 in making sure that that didn't happen anymore. And this particular story surprised me because easily the person in question, had he known about it and had he made a decision, could have gotten the permit for this animal because it was prior to the bill that he had the animal. And so I checked and found out from that there really was no wiggle room at all in the bill to allow the Ag Department to issue a permit to him after the fact. It was over. They had a particular window. It was done. So there was no option for them other than legislative. That encouraged me to have the meeting. We had what I believe was a really great meeting. We had a lot of conversations in that meeting about what would be the best way to proceed. And during that time, I think it was the ag people and the state veterinarian who said, I really think it would be in the best interest of Oregon if we could reopen a window of time and post it so people knew, because when we did the original bill, I think they said there were 57 animals that got permits, and that now there are 48 or so of those animals that are still alive, and each year they go to their house, they check that the animal is being taken care of, that they have proper management, and they can reissue the permit. And to me, that's the sane way of dealing with these animals over time. His estimate was that there may be four or five more of those animals who were not permitted. He doesn't know the total number, but he doesn't think it'll be an extreme amount. But there may be a few other animals that this window would give us the right opportunity to go in. Right now, they're keeping those animals under. They don't want anybody to know about them, so they're keeping them away from people if they even know the law exists. And it means that maybe they're not getting the veterinary help they should be getting. Maybe they're not being taken care of because the people are nervous that the animal will be taken away. My feeling is that this bill allows us to open a window, keeps the same bill intact, does not go to changing the bill, and says, if you're one of those people who didn't know this in the past, you better get it. We're going to give you one more opportunity. This is your chance to take care of those remaining animals. And it makes not only the animals safer, because you're going to have a veterinarian check them, you're going to have people look it over, but the state of Oregon safer, because we know where these animals are, which shouldn't be here. And in the near future, this animal has probably three or four more years if it lives out its life expectancy, and it can do that in the environment that it's been in the last rest of its life. So from my perspective, and I appreciate Senator Olson taking the advice of the people sitting in the room to change his bill completely, find the avenue to get this done and put up a bill that does exactly that. It doesn't change the intent of the law. It only says if you met the requirements of the law at the time, not any new animals, if you had the animal at the time, and you can show that and prove it, and you're willing to get your permit, and now from now on go through the procedures that we set up in 2009, then you can keep that animal. And I think that's the humane thing to do. So any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Senator. Representative, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough and members of the committee. It is nice to be here. I'd like to thank Senator Olson for taking the lead on this bill. I come to this issue, for the record, I'm Brent Barton. I represent Oregon House District 40, which includes the city of Gladstone, where the gentleman and animal behind this bill live. I'd like to thank Senator Olson for taking the lead on this bill. I think it'd be fair to say that I come to this issue from a different background and perspective on these issues than Senator Olson, and it's been fun to work on him on this bill. It brought us together a bit. You see, it could be said that I'm something of an animal lover. I have particularly cats, and almost humiliating affection for cats. I have a 100% career voting record for the Humane Society of the United States. I've carried some of the animal bills on the floor as they come through the House. I volunteer as pro bono legal counsel for the Oregon Humane Society. It is pathetic how much I love animals. And I deeply support the 2009 bill that I recall Senator Haas masterminding. Indeed, I remember it was March 11th, 2009. I remember it because it was my birthday, and I remember thinking what a great birthday present this bill is. However, like any bill, it was somewhat inflexible. And the thought that my constituent, with a cat that he clearly loves very much, after serving our country, this is his friend, this cat, that the law is so inflexible, a law that I support and care about and supported, would end up taking this cat away from him just seemed wrong to me. And I really would encourage this committee to look behind the bill and look at this situation and please work with us to try and find a way to get there. My opinions, the lynx in question, I believe, is 16 years old. They usually have a lifespan of 19 to 21 years, I'm told. My opinion on this particular situation might well be different if the lynx were, say, 10 years old or younger. But at 16 years old, moving it to a sanctuary at this point, I think would probably do more harm than good, both for the animal and certainly for the constituent in question. So having said that, again, I'd like to thank Senator Olson for bringing this approach. This is not the only way to solve this issue, and I would really appreciate your flexibility in working with us to try and keep this, let this lynx, let her live out her remaining years in peace. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representatives. And colleagues, we're going to be hearing further testimony on this after the next bill is heard, but if you have any questions of the Senator or the Representative, I'd be happy to entertain them. Okay, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you
for coming. Okay, I'm going to recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 1584. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1510. Senate Bill 1510 authorizes agencies of the Executive Department upon receipt of application for discretionary state permit for proposed action to nominate proposed action to Economic Recovery and Environmental Review Council for enhanced review as a project of statewide environmental significance. Colleagues, this bill, you'll notice, doesn't have a work session attached to it. It's public hearing only. And that's because its purpose is to initiate a conversation that I'm hoping will continue during the interim and into the next session around the problem of how we deal with projects that are, you know, major in scope that have large potential effects on the environment, the public health of the state as a whole, how do we address those issues as a state in a comprehensive way? You know, I see this as kind of similar to what we're doing with coordinated care in the health arena. How do we look at issues of potential large environmental impact in a coordinated manner? So we are going to be hearing from a number of people who are going to speak on this issue for and against the bill as it is. But let me again specify, the bill is here to initiate a conversation. You know, I asked for help in coming up with something that would meet the concerns about, you know, how do we look at things comprehensively, but in a way that would get the key agency players involved, that would have focused attention, that could actually have a potential to come to decision making in an expeditious manner. That's the goal here. So with that, we have several people who are on the phone. Many of them would have been happy to come today, but they would have had to bring their children, as it turned out. So for our sake, they decided to remain home and do this by phone, for which we are all appreciative. So let's...
I like kids. Come on. Don't paint me that picture.
Right. Yes. Well, knowing we were going to be talking about the lynx still, I was nervous. But anyway, let's start off. Rhett Lawrence, and then he'll be followed by Courtney Johnson, Michael Lang, Steve McCoy, and then in person we have Angela Crowley-Koch. So, Rhett, would you start off, please?
Sure thing. Thank you, Chair Dembro, member of the committee. My name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm the conservation director for the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club. And in addition to having my child home with me today, I'm also a little under the weather, so I apologize for being able to be there in person. But on behalf of the more than 20,000 members and supporters of the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club in Oregon, I did want to offer some brief comments on Senate Bill 1510. I also submitted some written comments earlier today, but sort of late in the morning, so I'm not sure if those made it into your packet. At any rate, Sierra Club has been raising the need for a more coordinated and comprehensive view of large environmental projects for a number of years now. And so we appreciate the opportunity to continue this discussion as part of this bill. And this bill would essentially create a state-level version of the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, which was enacted in 1970. And Washington and California have passed their own state versions in the early 70s, and both of those bills provide authority to state agencies in those states to do a comprehensive review of projects and consult with other state and federal agencies about the consequences of those projects. And I think you'll hear a bit more detail on that from Courtney Johnson in just a minute. Oregon, on the other hand, enacted its pioneering land use laws in that same time frame, and as you'll hear from Steve McCoy, those have served us well in many circumstances, but sometimes just can't cover the range of consequences for large projects that need to be considered. So, you know, obviously we can't have and wouldn't want a complex, extensive, and expensive permitting and review procedure for every single permit that the state of Oregon requires. But there are cases where more extensive review is needed, and our state agencies, frankly, just lack the authority required to protect the state and the citizens of Oregon. So, for example, there have been half a dozen coal export proposals in the Pacific Northwest, and in Washington, all of those projects are required to have major review by the state agencies. And in those cases, the state requirement has actually even resulted in better oversight by the relevant federal agencies as well. So, you know, but meanwhile, the only active coal export proposal in Oregon, the Port of Morrow facility near Boardman, could potentially move forward without a large-scale review or any kind of cross-agency coordination, even though some of those agencies that are involved recognize the potential for a significant impact, but just don't have the ability to require a larger review. So, you know, I just wanted to give a quick overview, and I'll turn it over now to the other panelists for more details, but did want to conclude by saying that we're Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club is certainly happy to be part of this discussion, and thank Chair Dembro, your idea of an interim work group to report back to the 2015 session might be a great outcome for this bill. So thank you very much for considering our comments, and now I'll turn it over to the rest of the panel.
Okay, thank you very much, Rhett. Courtney?
Yes, thank you, Chair Dembro and committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Courtney Johnson. I'm a staff attorney at Cragg Law Center. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the importance of Senate Bill 1510 and this discussion around adopting a state-level comprehensive environmental review law in Oregon. As an environmental attorney working in the public interest field in Oregon, I'm very familiar with our federal National Environmental Policy Act. The National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, serves as our nation's basic national charter for the protection of the environment. It declares a broad national commitment to protecting and promoting environmental quality. And to effectuate that national policy, NEPA requires that federal agencies prepare detailed environmental impact statements for every major federal action significantly affecting the quality of the human environment. NEPA, as it's known, requires the responsible federal agency to take a hard look at the proposal and its impacts, and this includes a review of direct, indirect, and cumulative effects, as well as a comparison of alternatives to the project. Agencies must make a fully informed and well-considered decision supported by quantified or detailed information, and NEPA requires public scrutiny of the agency's consideration and analysis. So the National Environmental Policy Act really doesn't force a particular outcome, but rather it requires an open, public, and informed review of the environmental impacts of an action. As Rhett mentioned, many other states have adopted what is sometimes referred to as NEPAs, or State Environmental Policy Acts. In Washington, it's the State Environmental Policy Act. In California, they have the California Environmental Quality Act. But essentially, those laws allow state agencies to take the same comprehensive, informed, and public review of projects that require state permits with discretionary approval. And as a practical matter, these laws and their required review mean that projects may not be approved as they're submitted if there are feasible alternatives or mitigation measures that would substantially lessen the significant environmental effects of a project. Currently, without such a law, our state agencies in Oregon are hamstrung by an inability to look at the cumulative impacts and direct and indirect effects of a proposed action or alternatives to that proposal. We're seeing more and more of these energy export proposals in Oregon, like coal export and LNG pipelines, that are exactly the type of action where these cumulative impacts and alternatives need to be evaluated. With the scope of these projects, our state is at a disadvantage when our agencies can only review one particular aspect of a project that clearly has a broader impact. For example, the Port of Morrow coal export terminal could be approved with only a few ministerial-type permits and with no significant environmental review, while similar projects in Washington at Longview and Cherry Point will undergo environmental impact review pursuant to the Washington State Environmental Policy Act. The federal law, NEPA, and its environmental impact statement serves a dual purpose. It ensures, on the one hand, that an agency, in reaching its decision, will have available and will carefully consider detailed information concerning significant environmental impacts. But it also guarantees that the relevant information will be made available to the public and the larger audience that may also play a role in the decision-making process. Adopting a State Environmental Policy Act equivalent would help ensure that Oregon state agencies have the same opportunity to adequately identify and consider the environmental consequences of their actions before committing to those actions, and the public to have the same opportunity to play a meaningful role in that decision-making process. Those are all my comments now, but I'm happy to stay on the line and answer questions if you have any for me.
Thank you, Courtney. Appreciate that. Okay, Michael Lang.
Thank you, Chair Dimbrough and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Lang. I'm Conservation Director for Friends of the Columbia Gorge. I just want to pause for a minute and ask you if the audio is coming through clearly.
It's great. Thank you.
Thank you. Friends appreciates the opportunity to comment on Senate Bill 1510. Conceptually, Friends supports the creation of a state environmental policy or environmental review process for projects that would have likely significant impacts on the environment. A little background, the Columbia River Gorge, as you probably know, is jointly managed by the states of Oregon and Washington and the federal government under the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area Act. The projects on the boundary, near the boundary, or in urban areas are exempted from the National Scenic Area Act. However, they can have significant effects on the Columbia River Gorge and its communities. Washington State, as has been mentioned by the previous panelists, does have a State Environmental Policy Act similar to NEPA. It's been in the books since 1971, and that does enable Washington State agencies to take a look at major projects that may have a likelihood of significant adverse effects and identify what the direct and the indirect and also the cumulative impacts of these major actions would be. CEPA also has substantive standards, so it can go a little further and even recommend mitigation measures to at least offset any adverse impacts that may occur. So to summarize the advantages of a State Environmental Policy Act that would be similar to Washington State, for one, it has a threshold determination, so it really weeds out by far the majority of projects that would not have a likelihood of significant adverse effects. And in doing so, it identifies those projects that really do have a likelihood of having a significant adverse effect. And those projects do require an environmental impact statement to be prepared. For major projects that do require this environmental impact statement, a really great thing about whether it's NEPA or SEPA is the identification of a range of alternatives that really helps decision makers determine, okay, is this exactly the best site or exactly the best design, or is another alternative that achieves the same goal out there that has lesser impacts. It also has substantive standards. Unlike NEPA, Washington SEPA does require consideration of mitigation measures that would reduce or offset overall project impacts down to a level that's acceptable. So projects may move forward minimizing the environmental impacts and community impacts. Also, it requires the consideration of not just direct, but also the indirect and the cumulative effects of a proposed action, so that communities are better informed of a project's likely impacts. And then overall, to summarize, it allows decision makers just to make better informed decisions. As mentioned by the previous panelists, there are coal export proposals in Washington State. All of them contemplate shipping coal by rail and open-top coal cars through the Columbia River Gorge. Because of Washington SEPA, the transportation impacts to places, special places like the Gorge, and rail communities in Washington State have to be analyzed and identified so the communities are better informed of what the potential impacts of these major coal exporting projects would be as they ship coal by rail through Washington State. In Oregon, we currently don't have that ability. So Oregonians, and justifiably so, we consider ourselves as being national leaders in sustainable development, in development that protects the environment, but we don't have this mechanism to identify and analyze the probable environmental effects of future proposed actions that require a permit from a local or state agency. In particular, we don't really get that grasp of the indirect and the cumulative effects of actions, nor can we really consider a range of alternatives. So in the absence of this State Environmental Policy Act, permitting agencies are really forced to limit the scope of review without considering broader long-term effects of the action on our communities. There are currently, I believe, 16 states and the District of Columbia that have some form of a State Environmental Policy Act. Now, California and Washington have been mentioned, but Georgia has a State Environmental Policy Act, Indiana, Maryland, Montana, New Jersey, North Carolina. These are Wisconsin, just a few of the other states that have been implementing some kind of Environmental Policy Act for years to better inform decisions. And Friends of the Columbia Gorge really thinks Oregon's at that point where we ought to step forward and allow our communities to better understand the impacts of major new projects that require permits from the state. We definitely support Oregon adopting some kind of State Environmental Policy Act. We do like the Washington State model because it does have some substantive standards, and it can hold a discussion of mitigation measures that can help offset the impacts of projects when they're approved. Thank you very much for considering these comments and for holding this hearing.
Thank you, Michael. Okay, Steve McCoy.
Chair Dembro and members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I am sorry I was unable to make it there in person today. Thank you for this opportunity to present testimony on enhanced environmental review for certain extraordinary projects. I'd like to spend a minute differentiating the enhanced review contemplated by this bill and Oregon's land use program. As you know, LCDC has produced 19 statewide land use planning goals. The goals express the state's policies on land use and related topics such as citizen involvement and housing. Most of the goals are accompanied by guidelines, which are simply suggestions about how a goal may be applied by a local government. Some of the goals also have statutes or administrative rules to help local government implement the goals and connect the goals. If LCDC has not adopted rules on a particular goal, the legislature, sometimes the legislature has written a statute around it, sometimes it hasn't. And if neither has done any work around it, then the goal is all but unenforceable. Goals 5, 6, 7, and 13 are the land use planning goals that most address the environment. Goal 5 is natural resources. It has been implemented, but in a very general manner, and it remains difficult to enforce. Goal 6 is air, water, and land resources quality, which has not been implemented in rule or statute, and is thus all but unenforceable. Goal 7 is areas subject to natural hazards, which, like Goal 6, has not been implemented in rule or statute and is all but unenforceable. And Goal 13 is energy conservation, which, like Goals 6 and 7, has not been implemented in rule. So the goals that were formulated to protect the environment aren't doing their jobs. We've dropped the ball in this manner. What about the land use goals that have been implemented? The implemented land use goals are achieved through local comprehensive planning. State law requires each city and county to adopt a comprehensive plan, and the zoning and land division ordinances need to put that plan into effect. Oregon's land use planning program inherently operates at the local level, giving local governments a framework to make local decisions. So what happens when a local land use decision or a series of local land use decisions have cumulative impacts? Nothing. Oregon's land use laws are not designed to evaluate the cumulative impacts of any particular decision. Our land use program is designed to protect private agricultural and timberlands for resource uses, and it does a very good job of that. However, it does not mitigate environmental impacts or take into account cumulative impacts. Due to the local focus of the land use program, this might be true even if Goals 5, 6, 7, and 13 were fully implemented. Oregon's land use program does a great job protecting natural resource lands from sprawling development. However, enhanced environmental review for extraordinary projects would see that Oregon's environment is also protected. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. So Steve is the last of our people testifying by phone. Why don't we pause here and see if there are any questions for Rhett or Courtney or Michael or Steve. Colleagues, do you have any questions?
I do.
Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
Ms. Johnson, are you still on the phone?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you very much. You had mentioned, I believe, the Longview Coal Export Facility.
Yes.
How long does a review take to get that facility through, or how long has it taken?
I don't have the exact numbers, but essentially when you have a state, for a project that would go through both the state environmental process as well as federal review, there's a provision that allows for the syncing up of those processes. So I don't believe that there are firm deadlines on how long that process can take, and some of the other people on the phone can answer this if they have specific information. But where you do have a situation where you have a process that might also be subject to a NEPA review, federal review, as well as a state review, then, for example, the State Environmental Policy Act allows the use of the National Environmental Policy Act documents to satisfy the state review. So there are some provisions that allow for the syncing up of those review processes. In other words, so you're not totally duplicating the review process. I don't have the information on exactly how long that process has been taking, but somebody else on the phone might have a more specific answer.
Could I do a follow-up? Does anyone on the phone have that answer? Are we talking years, months, days?
This is Michael Lang. It's more on the order of a year or more for that specific proposal. That's my understanding of it. I don't think there's a drop-dead date or deadline for the permitting agencies to issue a decision. Under the rules for other agencies like Washington, FSEC, the Energy Facility Siting and Evaluation Council, they review, for example, the proposed oil terminals The oil terminal in Vancouver that's proposed is under FSEC's jurisdiction. Its goal is to enter or reach a decision on site certification in 12 months, and that includes completion of an EIS under state SEPA.
Maybe I could follow up for anyone. currently under our existing land use laws, how long would it take to get permits, say, for that project from the Port of Morrow?
This is Steve McCoy. Generally, there is either a 120-day, 150-day, or 180-day requirement in Oregon's land use laws that the permitting authority issue the permits within that time for the land use portion. Generally, for something like this, it's going to be 150 days.
Okay. And what if it were subject to a NEPA analysis? How long would that take?
I can't really answer that.
So this is Courtney Johnson again. Thank you. There's no specific timelines, but I'm just looking now to go back to the Longview project, and it looks like that initial project was the application was filed in 2012, and they're expecting to finish the final environmental impact statement in 2014. So it looks like about a two-year process. But another important thing to keep in mind is that we're not talking about just the land use approval. So our state land use program has these really clear and set deadlines for land use approvals. But one of the biggest issues with that is that you don't have this coordinated review. And as Steve was pointing out, our land use laws really don't have an environmental review component. And if they do, it's entirely up to the local county or city that's responsible for that review to be implementing that. Just for example, I've recently been tracking the terminal and the pipeline approvals out of Coos County for the Jordan Cove LNG proposal. And there, the terminal and the associated South Dunes power plant are in an area that's zoned for industrial development. And so there really is no substantive environmental review that occurs with that, despite the fact that that project has a myriad of effects and connected actions with it, including a pipeline that includes almost 400 stream crossings, the dredging of a huge portion of Coos Bay, and an immense amount of fill being placed on the North Spit, the development of a power plant, not to mention the increase in shipping traffic in that area and the actual transport of liquefied natural gas. And so I think it's a bit unfair to compare the timelines of the land use review component alone as compared to a review of those a coordinated review between agencies of those environmental impacts across the board. And in fact, there's a possibility and there's an ability to actually shorten the overall timelines by allowing agencies with different review components to work together and avoid duplication of efforts rather than segmenting out each particular piece of the review to be done independently by different agencies at different state, local, and federal levels of review.
Thank you for me. Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
Ms. Johnson, in 1510, under Section 5, it says an association or organization has standing to request a contested case hearing. Is this typical in most things, as we senators don't have standing in our own law? Why would we give standing to an association or an organization?
Thank you. Most laws and most of these environmental review laws, as I mentioned in my initial testimony, one of the primary purposes is to allow for public participation and disclosure of these effects to the public. So at the federal level, an organization or an individual can gain standing to appeal a decision made pursuant to the National Environmental Policy Act only where you could show that you're actually adversely affected or aggrieved. And there's been quite a bit of federal case law and cases that have addressed exactly what an organization or an individual needs to show in order to meet that level of standing. So certainly there's really it's very important that there be an opportunity for an appeal. Otherwise, that provision for providing for public input is really kind of rendered meaningless if there's no resolution and there's no ability to enforce that provision to make sure that the public is included in the process. Does that answer your question?
It does, but wouldn't the public hearings that would be held by the agency, wouldn't that be the venue for public testimony rather than an opportunity to seek litigation?
It would be, and you're absolutely right. And in general, you wouldn't be allowed to seek a litigation type approach without having participated at the local level. And in fact, because most of these laws or the provisions that we're talking about are about providing that access and that procedure, a person appealing that component would have to show that that procedure hadn't been followed. So again, this would just be, in general, this is a way to enforce the requirement to have those public hearings and have that opportunity and have the information disclosed to the public, rather than a way to get around and kind of do a gotcha at the end by keeping your mouth shut and saying, oh, yeah, we'll get them later. You have to build into the record, the way at least the national environmental policy work is, you have to build into the record and show that you raised issues and you asked these agencies to address significant environmental impacts and that they either failed to do so or failed to provide you the opportunity to do so. That's where the next step of the appeal would come in.
Right. I have another one. And I realize that this is just the beginning,
right.
But I want to get these situations and these things vetted. Sure. It says under Section 5 that the nature of the claim and the relief requested do not require members of the association or organization who are adversely affected or aggrieved to participate in the contested case hearing. That sounds to me like it's a door to open it up for litigation from anywhere in the world. Because those people that are aggrieved don't have to stand and be put in front of the people that are trying to get their process through. So how would you, as a lawyer, how would you answer that? Does that seem like it's a little open door policy?
To be honest, I can't speak specifically to that provision. I definitely understand that reading that seems to leave a door open, but I honestly can't speak to what the purpose of that specific provision was in this draft of the bill.
Thank you.
Again,
Chair Dembrough?
Yes.
This is Michael Lang.
Yes,
in reading that provision, I understand that to mean that in order for an organization to participate in a contested case, that its specific members that are aggrieved do not have to personally participate.
So the
and I would just ask if that's the intent, if that's the correct interpretation. Thank you.
I believe that was the intent. So the organization can represent its members in that. Again, I think, you know, our goal here in this piece of legislation, or, you know, as we're envisioning this, is to come up with something that will ideally avoid litigation and streamline a process if possible. Yes?
If I may ask,
Senator,
were you going to wrap up?
If you have a quick question, and then we'll move to the in-person people.
I don't care. I haven't read the whole. This is Senator Bill Hansel. I've not read the entire act, so it may be answered within it. But in Section 2, under B and C in particular, when I see words like will have a probable significant adverse impact, require an enhanced consideration because of the probable significant adverse impacts of proposed action. How do you is that defined, the probable significant aspect? Isn't that in the eye of the beholder? What type of standards do we have for that? I don't care who answers.
Yeah, I don't know, Michael, if you have a sense of that in terms of how it's being implemented in Washington State. I think, you know, the goal with that was that this is not what's being envisioned is not a project, is not a process that's open to every project, but only those in which there, you know, is likely going to be that kind of, you know, significant impact. I'm not sure how the threshold would be set, if that's something that would be set in rulemaking or what.
Well, that, Mr. Chair, is exactly my question. It's in the eye of the beholder, it would seem to me, because the groups that are speaking there, some of the examples that they used, I'm not sure, in my opinion, would necessarily qualify for this, but it certainly qualifies in their opinion. So I'm just curious if there's some type of standard someplace by which we will hang our hats on what is a probable significant impact, worst case scenario. I mean, that's probably something, as if and this bill moves, that would be very important for me to try to figure out what that is, because right now it seems to be pretty squishy.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Okay, well, people on the phone, you're welcome to hang with us, but we're going to move now to the in-person testimony. Let me again thank you for accommodating this time, and you had a lot to offer. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Nembro.
So I'll call up Angela. Gallagher, please. Joe Esmond. Tom Gallagher.
Hello.
Sorry.
First attempt.
Oh, Mr. All right, John, you lost your place. You'll be in the next panel. Okay, Angela.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Angela Crowley Cook, the Legislative Director for Oregon Environmental Council. And OEC is here today to support SB 1510. We believe a program like this would contribute to a stronger, healthier, more resilient Oregon. Now, all the smart people on the phone already testified about all the details, and I submitted written testimony. So I just want to talk for a minute about the big picture. I think you'll hear other folks today testify about how there are already a lot of permits and processes that different projects need to go through, and that is true. You know, there's land use, there's DEQ, there are a number of things. However, I want to make sure that Oregon is not like the fable of the group of blind people feeling the different parts of the elephant, if you've heard that story, where one person holds the leg of the elephant and thinks it's a tree, someone holds a tusk and they think it's something else. In any case, this proposal is to make sure we're looking at the 10,000-foot level. We're seeing the entire project instead of just the various pieces and looking at, like others spoke of before, the cumulative impact, so we can see the whole elephant and not just all the pieces. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Angela.
Go ahead. Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond. I am a business agent for the IBW Local 48, based in Portland, Oregon, representing 4,400 union electricians, men and women. I'm not on the sheet. It was yes or no, opposed. I'll be in the gray area. I'm here to say that, one, Oregon does have a very good history of environmental stewardship. Two, we live in silos here in government down here, because right down the hallway, this way or that way, there are people there looking for money for various things. Usually it's to fix the safety net. Businesses have to grow responsibly, and I just don't want to lose sight that one of the riches of the state, of any state, are the citizens. And I don't think the average citizen, union, non-union, blue collar, gray collar, has the ability or the legal background to spend hours and hours to put their case forward why they need jobs in that area. How many, you know, so I just think it's unfair. I think we should do this a smarter way. I like, if this board goes forward, I'd like to have some people there who actually are immediately affected in their home district, home area, not being legislated, decided by other people. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing multiple clients, including the Portland Business Alliance. I want to say a few positive things about what I think is the direction of the chair here. There'll be people behind me that offer you a lot of specifics about why this particular iteration that's offered to you to work on this problem is not very well developed or very effective. I think it's reasonable in Oregon to think that we have two goals. One is environmental protection, and the other is a reasonable permitting process that people can enter into, and it flows fairly clearly, and in that process, the environmental issues are dealt with. I don't think we have that. I've been involved in for about 20 years here in this building working on regulatory reform, working on environmental issues, and almost every one of those processes has come to a grinding halt because of the inabilities of the parties to make any kind of concessions or make any kind of effort to find a reasonable middle ground. If you're going to proceed forward and turn this into something other than a vote-getting process on an environmental bill which twists the Democratic Party around and unites the Republican Party, you're going to have to find a process that works here. Where we have multiple state agencies involved in a permit, that is a problem. They can be done sequentially. They can be done, and it works for both sides. Sometimes an individual interest group will play one agency off another. Sometimes they're more effective in one agency than they are in the other. So there are many ways to delay the process. There are many ways to, in justice, to try to get the environmental issues worked out. But I think we do need a single process for many of these cases where there is total jurisdiction in the decision-making body, where there's a single decision-making body, and there's a single appeals process. Put all the pieces in one place and work your way through them. I just say in the past we've had many attempts to do this, and all of them have fallen apart. And they've fallen apart in some cases because of the good efforts of the people who are involved. We did one trying to get a single process for film removal permit. And it was a graduate course in regulatory government for me. And the reason that process fell apart were very simple. The agencies were funded in different ways. Some had fees, some had general fund. That's a huge problem unless you take that on originally because the agency has to protect their involvement in the process. Another reason they fell apart was that the permittees objected. The consultants that were involved in the permit process understood the current process, and they didn't want to change it. And there was a reluctance on the part of even the permitting side to make any changes or make any gives on it. The issues on the environmental side, assuming that it's not simply a process to stop the project, assume that there's an old joke about how we used to have a sign-up sheet. I'm for the permit. I'm against the permit unless certain changes are made, and I'm just against the permit. That's true. And if people really want to get involved and make this a process that does the best it can to protect the environment, then I think we have something we can work with. I'll just say that I don't think here, as all of you go forward in this, I don't think a solution is the best interest in either of the interest groups. And I hope that you find a way to put a process together, and I've been involved in some of the state, which have worked on solutions. I'm going to use this one nice one. The workers' comp in Mahoney Hall, the last special session. The legislature has been able to put together a process in the past that is a balanced process that meets the two goals of environmental protection and a reasonable permitting process. And I think that's possible. I think you folks have to take control of that. I don't think the interest groups are going to enter into this with the ability to make those compromises that will make this work. And I certainly hope you think you get it done, because in a sense, I agree with Joe. I don't think we could cite a pulp and paper mill in the state of Oregon, which for years has been important to the rural Oregon. And as Gene Durfler used to tell me, I don't think we could cite I-5 in the state of Oregon. And the reason for that is not because anyone is wrong, vicious, or opposed. We have too much process. We have too much process that takes the decision out of the hands of the policymakers and puts it in the hands of the court. All of these projects will end up in court. And I don't think that's the right way to solve our political, our social, or our economic problems. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments, Tom. Any questions of the panelists? Okay, thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry.
Joe, you're not, potentially not off the hook,
This is for the, I guess it's for anybody in the panel. I read through this as carefully as I could, trying to make some sense out of it, and been around building 10 years now, so I have a little bit of understanding of it. Mr. Gallagher, I already agree with what you're saying. You know, it would seem to me if you want to set something like this up, which I think has value for four or five large projects every biennium, that you should do more than just look at it from an environmental point of view. This, cause that's why the sense I get is being looked at just from an environmental point of view, and just another layer in here.
Public health as well is
okay.
Part of it.
But it says Economic Recovery and Environmental Review Council, what you want to call it, this new group. Could you consider the possibility, if you have this large group overlooking all this, at the same time all the permitting goes to that same group at the same time? So you have a way of getting all the permitting done and the environmental impact statement done, and you don't have to go through step by step by step. But I take a little bit from my personal life and my public life. This is the issue we have with CCOs, and we're still working through that, but it's getting better. And I I'm just completing some work on developing some land along the Rogue River and trying to get through with FEMA and the county and PP&L and DEQ. I'm missing two or three others. Just for that little tiny thing we're doing there, I can imagine what a statewide project would look like. And that took almost a year.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates. I think what you're saying is the right direction. And just let me put some caveats on that I think as you go into this. Number one, whatever body you set up, and the way they set this one up is maybe good, maybe bad. I'm not commenting on that. They have to have sole jurisdiction. And all those other agencies that have statutory direction in here, all that has to be cleaned up. I mean, it's got to be one place. There's got to be one fee. There's got to be a competent staffing. One of the issues they have with FSEC, which is a common energy facility siting process, is because the staffing is done through the Department of Energy, but they also contract out for consultants to do a great deal of the work. So if you get into those level of details and say, how could we have a body of the state of Oregon that has the statutory authority, the competency of staff, the singleness of purpose, I think that's a sensible direction. I think that you can do a little bit better job of defining which projects go there. Then that's a process that everybody will work out. That's not a big issue about this bill. It's just a starting point. So I agree.
Senator Hinton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been around the building quite as long, Tom, as has my colleague, Senator Bates. But I believe we have a department called the Department of Environmental Quality. Are we saying that they're not doing their job or they could do it better? You've listed all the things that made it sound like there's nothing in existence now that does the very thing that you're wanting to do. And DEQ has to come forward with the permits. Are we saying that we need to reevaluate that? I'm a little bit curious as what's happening.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hansel, DEQ has certain authorities. In many of these cases, we're talking about things that are outside the jurisdiction of DEQ or have duplicate authority, water quality issues. We may be talking about in land use process, sensitive sites, historical sites. There are all sorts of things when you're running a project, especially one that's a linear project that covers multiple areas, that bring in lots of different places. I think over the years that the DEQ process has developed so that I'm much more comfortable with it in 2014 than I was in 2084, but it is not comprehensive enough. And secondly, we've seen this in some of the large projects that have gone forward, some of the export Bradwood Landing and so forth, where there's a much bigger involvement than just the agency. Now, there's a much bigger policy issue here involved. And that policy issue, I think, is something that that it would be good to have a responsible body for it. And there are many games played with that permitting, and games are just the use of the law in the way that benefits the outcome you're looking for. And so I don't think DEQ by itself is adequate to handle that. Thank you.
Yes, Angela.
If I can address actually both Senator Bates and Senator Hansel's questions. One of the attractive things about this proposal is that there is some streamlining involved and the agencies talking together. That's the kind of streamlining we like to see. Make things more simple, have people talk together, and make it an easier process for everyone. The kind of streamlining that we have concerns about is when instead of consolidating steps, steps are skipped. And that's kind of what raises a red flag for us and requires this very type of proposal.
Mr. Esmond.
Yeah, I just want to make sure again, it'd be nice if some of these people have all these ideas of good ideas and in the interest of revelation. I have a son going for a master's in environmental science, and he's a good kid. But no. And I planted trees at one time.
Are you paying for his schooling?
Nope. Nope. He's on his own.
He is a good kid.
Real good kid.
The favorite. I wish these people on the phone and other people who want to do all these good things would sit down for an hour or two or live a life. There was a person years ago, was a minister from Ohio, I believe. He went out around the country and did a job like working people did, so he understood what working people go through. And I'm not saying electricians. I'm saying the people who got to work in the mill or have to work in the mill or lay concrete or put up fences someplace. So they understand from a holistic, it's a word I hesitate to use, but to understand how they view the world, what they have to do to survive. They don't have, so I don't want to, I'm getting a little red here, so maybe in your wisdom, Mr. Chair, you can make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Mr. Olson.
For any in the panel, my concern with this bill basically is we're putting the environment over the economy. And I think there needs to be a very firm balance between there. For example, the LNG facility in Coos Bay. My understanding is greatly wanted, greatly needed. Creates a lot of jobs, puts a lot of economic vitality into the community. But yet, under this this bill, anyone could stand forward and say, I've been aggrieved, and put a whole process in there. And I agree with Mr. Gallagher. This needs to go in where it's refined, that one agency can go in and make those decisions and move things forward in one chance at a judicial, not a judicial, but a hearing to maybe change the minds of people to make it work. It just seems that we want to put Oregon at a disadvantage to the rest of the world by what we do environmentally. And I love this state. This is a great state. But we also have to remember that there are people out there that need jobs. And bills like this kind of nibble away, if you will, at those job opportunities. If a business comes in and you make them prepay for a hearing, does someone want to put up $2-5 million to get through this process, knowing full well that at the end they don't have anywhere to turn, because in here it says that the Land Use Board of Appeals does not have jurisdiction. There's no way to get an appeal on it. It makes business shy away, and that scares me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, again, I've been here a number of years where businesses complain they wouldn't be able to comply with something, and over time they learn how to comply with it. I can remember sitting in here doing a Clean Air Act, and I thank God didn't work on a Clean Water Act. What I would say to you is that what I think we're lacking is for the ability for a political or public policy body to make a decision to find the balance. There are none of these facilities that will go in that will not have an impact on the environment. They will. There has got to be a policy directive in the state that says you have to do everything. There's certain things we won't let happen, and this is a state where there's certain things we shouldn't let happen. Then there's got to be a step which says we need to make sure that that person coming in, and the kind of projects we're talking about, these people do have pretty deep pockets. That's really not the issue, that we're pushing a small business out of the way. that they have to do everything they can to mitigate that identified environmental damage. And then thirdly, a decision has to be made along the lines that Joe is talking about, that in the balance here, in the balance, it's better for the state of Oregon to have this facility than not to have this facility, and there will be some environmental impacts. And that's what I think, if you go forward on this, that's the goals you ought to have.
I think that's very well stated, Tom. Yes,
just Angela. Very quickly, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, thank you for that concern. And we obviously at OEC, we want jobs too. We want job growth. There's higher unemployment in Oregon than many other states. And so the goal of this is not to put us at an economic disadvantage, since Washington and California already have similar types of reviews. So we wouldn't be at a competitive disadvantage to our neighbors. But I think it would help us take that 10,000-foot view, like I said, and make sure we're looking at everything instead of things individually.
Thank you, Angela. Okay, I'm going to call up the last panel now. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, let's call the panels coming up. I'd like to make a statement to Senator Olson. The Coos Bay Terminal is great with me as long as the pipeline goes through your county, not mine.
Okay, we have John Ledger and John Chandler and Sean Gilliatt.
Thank you. I can start if you like.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. This topic is near and dear to me. In a prior life, I was a regulator when Cecil Andrus was governor of Idaho. I ran air programs and cleanup programs, issued a lot of permits, got beat up at a lot of public hearings, and issuing a permit is always a tricky thing to do. There are some things about this bill that concern us, and there are some opportunities, too. When someone applies for a permit, it's important. There are lots of pieces that are important to businesses. One of them, of course, is certainty of outcome, where you know what you need to do to get a permit, and if you do that, you will get the permit, and also the timeliness of how long it takes to get a permit. And in a bill like this, one of the concerns that gets raised, of course, is that this permitting procedure goes from a predictable, fairly routine type of permit, for whatever reason, into another layer of permitting that is much more extensive, much more expensive, and unknown amount of time, which would make a project very debatable as to whether we go forward or not. There were comments about the mechanism whereby a project would be tagged of being statewide significance. And there's just about nothing you can think of that you can't really roll into that if you want to. An agency simply has to identify it. So permits are not just technical documents. They are also have a large piece of social implications to them and are often surrogates for social issues. You heard a lot of talk about coal. And I think that something like the coal issue is something that would drive a piece of legislation like this. And I think a proper way to address a coal issue would be to address the coal issue. If you have a bill that relates to coal or regulates coal as opposed to something that's more of a catch-all where no one really knows if they're going to get caught into this or not. Now, on the plus side, there have been efforts, I've been involved with them for years, to actually do permit streamlining, where you would have more consultation between agencies, you'd have more sharing of data, you'd have more overlap of responsibility. This is the governor's regulatory streamlining simplification project. It was just issued, and in it, it has some examples and projects that agencies are working on to simplify and streamline the permitting process, because it's widely acknowledged that it's slow and cumbersome. Oregon has some of the most stringent standards in the nation. Some of them are impossible to comply with, notably water, for instance. It is not easy to get a permit in Oregon for anything. There's a lot of public process involved. Sometimes it takes years. On the Columbia River, to take 3 more feet off the bottom of an already dredged channel, it took 15 years to get the permit. There's a lot built into the permit system now, including cumulative numbers, for instance, in air or water. You take into account what else is there. So I would encourage the committee to look at ways to streamline and to take a bigger picture. I think that's a good idea. I would also encourage the committee to look at ways where this would not be viewed as something that could get triggered for any reason. And when you're going to have a panel or somebody decide which one of these things get dropped into the significance barrier or significance basket, that gives that person or agency incredible power that is not predictable and is certainly subject to political influence. Who would be doing that and why? I don't know if it should be political or be policy. It should be more if you, here's what you need to do to get a permit. If you follow the law, do everything right, you get your permit. And you know about how long it's going to take. The governor's office convenes heads of its departments in the natural resource agencies. They meet, I don't know how often, might be weekly, and I think that would be a logical place when something big comes up to organize a comprehensive view and to make sure the agencies talk to each other. There's a lot that can be done to make things run better and faster. I just think we need to be very careful about how we do it. One person previously noticed that only 16 states have these, which means the majority of states do not have a state EIS, and there's probably a reason for it. But with that, I'd be happy to pass it on and take questions later. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Sean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians with Tonkentorp, representing a variety of clients, including the Oregon Association of Realtors. I think we need to take a bit of a step back as we kind of look at this bill in isolation and take a broader look at our land use system in general. It was interesting to hear the perspectives of some of the first callers that they feel that the process is too local driven. I think Mr. Chandler and I almost fell out of our chairs because we tend to think of it the exact opposite way, that the process is actually too state driven with our, you know, unique land use system that no other state has replicated yet. And so when we talk about potentially our land use system is front-loaded, where we determine upfront what land should come in and be developed, adding an additional layer on the back end and talking about the systems of Washington or California, to us doesn't really seem like apples to apples. You know, if we want to look in the interim, Mr. Chair, happy to have you over here now getting into the land use fights. Be careful what you wish for on those things. But I think there are a lot of components of Washington's Growth Management Act that those of us in the development community would love to see implemented in Oregon. If those components coming in were coupled with something along these lines, I think that'd be a trade-off that we'd be willing to look at. But just piling on simply to us is concerning. It's also interesting the language that's used for this particular bill was actually put in statute in 2009, Senate Bill 766, which some of you are familiar with, which was an attempt to streamline industrial sites and bring these agencies together in an attempt to make it quicker. I would say that thus far, 766 has not been successful. We only have two sites that are qualified in the state thus far, and no one really interested in going to those two sites. So, it was interesting to see that something that was attempting to streamline and speed things up, now we're adding additional layers onto it when we weren't even successful getting 766 to work. And it does kind of come down to a lot of the talks that we've had over the last few years about industrial land supply in the state, the lack of it, especially once you get outside of the Portland metro area. We're happy, Mr. Chair, to continue that conversation about how there might be some gives and takes and how we could balance all the needs better with our land use system. With that, I'm sure Mr. Chandler has some pithy comments to make.
Pithy comments are us, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, and I was pleased, Senator Bates, to hear your experiences. I'll have a membership application dropped by your office. Welcome to the grand world of developing in Oregon. Mr. Chairman, members, this bill is problematic. Testimony, as was earlier mentioned, of for or again is not really applicable to this sort of a process. This bill has come up, or this concept has come up many times in my time in the Capitol. It has always the same problems. And part of the problem is we're not quite sure, we collectively are not quite sure what it is we are trying to accomplish, and so therefore we have a devil of a time figuring up a process and a procedure and a path that's going to get us there. And that really is a problem. I remember, I don't know how many bills I've participated in on the flip side of this issue, trying to speed up the development and the economic process and get through the permit, and they die. They die in some chamber or another, in some committee or another. This bill, were it to move forward, very likely suffer the same death. I don't like that my bill's dying. I wouldn't be unhappy with this bill dying, but the fundamental problem we have is we weren't quite sure in any of those efforts what economy we're trying to develop, what environmental protections we're trying to make sure don't get eroded or instituted in the first place, and because in some ways we have substituted process and permitting as a big, extended, expensive process for the hard decision of what it is we want the state to be when it grows up. And this bill, as a framework for that discussion, might be pretty useful. If all this bill does, or its successor iterations do, is create another layer of hoops through which people have to maneuver, it'll be a colossal waste of time and effort. We got no shortage of hoops. I was tickled by the earlier panel that seemed to think we did. That's what makes this a fun process, and the Hegelian dialectic continues. But we do have a fair amount of hoops already. It's starting with a little bit of a history lesson, which I've given, the chair has heard this before, and I apologize for repeating, but it's worth doing, I think. I was around, but I wasn't paying attention when the National Environmental Policy Act was passed in 1970. I was in junior high. When Oregon's land use program was adopted in 1973, I was junior in high school. My point there is not my agedness, but the fact that we knew when we adopted comprehensive land use planning, when Moses come down from Mount Sinai with Senate Bill 100 under his arms, we knew about NEPA. We didn't do it in a vacuum. We understood there was a National Environmental Policy Act. We knew that other states had adopted state-level environmental policy acts, and we deliberately, on purpose, with a lot of thought, adopted a different path in this state to look at a comprehensive land use planning system with, at the start, fewer than 19 goals. Now, as mentioned earlier, 19 goals looking at all facets. I've always been nervous about a substitution of or an intersection of other policy that really have a fundamentally different starting point. In terms of their underlying philosophy. If we were to swap out and say we're going to junk Oregon's land use planning system and go to a SEPA level, a SEPA type, that'd be a discussion to have. I wouldn't recommend it. But to have simply our current land use system with all of its protections, checks and balances, and years of litigation and legislation that's gone on, to have then another layer on top of that, such as this bill would seem to imply, leaving aside the fact I think it's a bad idea, I think it'd be disastrous, because you don't know what the outcomes are going to be. One of the things that is supposedly happening under Oregon land use laws, Mr. Ledger already mentioned, is a certainty. If you have a project, if you have a particular thing you are doing that is allowed, that there is you can get through it. And there's timelines, as already mentioned. They are honored in the breach more often than not, but there are timelines. In fact, the entire idea of a permit process implies that if you go through it in the proper sequence and repeat the necessary incantations and whatnot on the way, you can, in fact, get your permit. Oftentimes, a complicated permit process is, like I said earlier, a surrogate for the actual issue, which is we don't want you to do that. And so we're just going to torment you until you give up. And that's not what a permit process is supposed to do. Permit processes and Oregon land use law is premised on this, and it really does work relatively well, even though I reserve the right to come in and contradict myself on that point, depending on the legislation in front of you. I've been relying on my clients having short memories. Hopefully you will oblige me the same way. But on most things under Oregon land use law, if you are in compliance with the laws, the ordinances, goals, and so forth, you can actually get through in a relatively, compared to other states, quick fashion. This type of process is open-ended as it would be, and without any sideboards, and I realize it's a work in progress, but my fear is that for a lot on the let's stop things from happening front, then a complicated open-ended process is exactly what they want, because at some point entropy kicks in and people just tip over. Applicants just to say the heck with it and go elsewhere. I really do think that there is value. In fact, the report that Mr. Ledger just showed you, I was involved with that. I was involved in every other iteration going back several governors, trying to streamline, fix, amend, pick your modifier Oregon's permitting process, none of which have been successful. And I think that partly because we've never actually had that open conversation as a state, or the extent that we can have such a thing through representatives of the people, what it is we're trying to accomplish, how we're going to know when we're done. I will point out that this bill, as I already mentioned, I hate to wordsmith things I'm probably going to oppose, but with your permission, the way this is written is far too broad. If you're going to I don't care who said it, if you're going to take Vienna, take Vienna. If you're mad about or worried about, concerned about a particular activity, then talk, like Mr. Ledger said, if you're worried about coal, talk about coal. Don't talk about things around coal. Don't talk about the three activities over. A reasonably large subdivision will get snagged up by this bill, potentially. I don't think that's the intention. But it, the overbreadth of trying to cover as many parts of the waterfront as we can, I think, causes a lot of problems, not the least of which is it's simply unworkable then, because then it becomes one more process. As with my fellow panelists, I'd be more than happy to participate in this process going forward. I think it is an important discussion on both sides, as was mentioned. How do we create jobs? How do we protect the environment? They're not at all contradictory. They can't be. But that's we tend to treat them that way because the interest groups on all sides tend to interact with the process in ways that advance their particular causes and without necessarily in regard or not as much regard to the overall picture as should be. I commend it'll be quite an undertaking. It's too bad I'm busy the month you're doing it, but I would otherwise.
Don't worry. I think it'll take more than
we're glad to take any questions.
Yes, thank you, John. Thank you, all three of you. I just want to say, you know, with respect to the issue of coal and having a bill on coal, I mean, one of the purposes of a process is being envisioned here is to, you know, really look at the implications of, you know, a coal export project in a really sustained and ideally scientific and detailed way, as well as looking at economic ramifications, et cetera, as opposed to just having it be thrown, you know, strictly into the hands of the political process. I mean, yes, it may need to wind up there, but, you know, if we can avoid that, you know, I think that's a good thing.
Mr. Chairman, if I can, coal, and it's always, when you're in our positions, you'd never want to be accused, and it certainly wasn't our intention to shove any other interest group friend off the back of the sled, because that's bad form, especially if you do it on the record. But that was a joke. Coal is a surrogate. It could be subdivisions. Right. It could be Walmart. It could be pick your activity. It could be balloon launches. It doesn't matter. If that's what's causing the anxiety or if that's the focal point, then that's really what we should be talking about, because as you broaden out, and I'm just talking from a practical standpoint, then you not only broaden out the scope of the potential legislation, you broaden out the scope of opposition. Or, said differently, you broaden out the scope of people who are ecstatic that their issue is finally going to get talked about, only to be dashed when, in fact, they don't care about balloon launches, but they really cared about something else. And I think the fundamental issue you'd have to think about is I can't imagine, using coal as an example, I don't know that much about it, that the feds are just sitting back and tossing cards in a hat while coal trains are rolling. There's got to be NEPA processes they have to go through or some sort of permitting activity, not knowing the federal regulatory system as well as I do the state, but they aren't slackers. If whatever we do here at the state level, you have to keep in mind what's happening at the national level and what gaps would we be filling, whether it be that activity or something else. And that's one of the concerns we've had over the when these bills have come up, is that you inevitably run into that federal process, which is hard to get through. And the whole point, back to the land use system, was to have an Oregon-based process that was more predictable, understandable, and quick. If you start blurring those, you're getting into that area between federal and state regulation. It tends to just cause all immense problems and a loop that applicants get stuck in, and then before entropy hits them.
Thank you, John. Senator Hansel, you can have the last question.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gallagher referred to it earlier. You talked about more hoops, too much process. Do we run the risk that if we continue to add more and more of these things, that the chance for litigation, tying up, using the courts, becomes more and more a reality? Right now, every forest sale in the state of Oregon pretty much gets appealed right off the top. Are we just adding to the possibility that we shut the door for Oregon development because we just keep adding greater and greater levels, more hoops, as you said?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hansel, my opinion is absolutely yes. More process, lawyers drive process, IR1, any activity has to, you have to have a remedy, you have to have an appeal. Once that happens, then there has to be an appeal of the appeal. That's what causes our process to get tangled up, and it's not done with that intention, but that's almost in every case I can think of, that's the outcome. Because Mr. Gallagher and I have laughed about this before, you really do need to have, there are three categories. I like it if you do it slightly differently. I hate it. And we've kicked around the idea, maybe we should just have a law that says the I hate it should be given a pass, and we'll see you at the Court of Appeals. Thanks for coming by. We understand your concerns. You don't need to waste everybody's time telling us you hate it at several different levels. We'll preserve your rights to brief the issue, and off you go. That might speed things up quite a bit, because there are some, in some cases, people who are simply opposed, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's a perfectly legitimate position to have. Using the process to tangle up everybody while you're getting to the ultimate appellate stage, maybe that's not necessarily a good use of resources.
I think one of the concerns is a permit, business sees a permit as fairly objectively, you know, you apply for the permit, you hire your engineers, you pay, you get your permit. But permits have get all entangled up in the social fabric of a state. And the example I always use is if you had a plant that was going to build ball bearings, and it was building ball bearings for a wind generator, power generator by wind, it would be a green job, and everyone would think it was wonderful, and they'd probably get their permit pretty easily. If they found out they were making those ball bearings for predator drones, you might have a different reaction to the permit issuance. And that causes a lot of concern within the business community on how their business is going to be affected by views that they have no control over when they see the world as engineers and scientists. And that's one of the concerns this raises, and concerns about having somebody or some committee kind of make the selection, this is one and this isn't.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. And, you know, raising a number of issues that I think I think really helping to frame what we're going to need to consider going forward. I think this has been a very useful conversation. So stay tuned, and we'll figure out where we're going next with this. Any ideas that any of you have, I would be very much open to them. So thank you. With that, I'm going to end this public hearing on Senate Bill 1510 and reopen the hearing on Senate Bill 1584, the exotic animal bill. And we have one person who signed up to speak, George Okulich. And again, if you came in late, we have carried over the Klamath bill and the radon bill. We're waiting more amendments on those. Oh, George, you are not alone.
I am not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. For the record, my name is Senator Alan Olson. I represent Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. A little background information on the situation that we are involved with today. I saw a press release and news article on a gentleman in Gladstone who had a lynx, and he's had this lynx for 16 years. He got this lynx when it was 10 days old. According to the article, January 9th was the day that this gentleman must either remove this lynx and put it in a sanctuary or have it euthanized. So I looked at the issue and saw that we had a bill, Senate Bill 391, which was written in 2009 by some very good senators and representatives, and it was engrossed. In that year, there was 2,613 bills written. 919 were engrossed, so that's 919 new laws. For this situation, unfortunately, this gentleman who lived in Milwaukee for 14 years and never had a problem, Milwaukee never came forward and said he had to do anything with the lynx. He did not understand that the bill was out there, did not know it was available, and that he had to permit himself. He moved to Gladstone, where he subsequently found out that this lynx was in violation of Senate Bill 391. I contacted the city of Gladstone, asked for an extension of the time to get it past January 9th to see if we could do something with the law. And what we found was that 391 is an exceptional bill. It does what it was intended to do. And that what it did was allow people that had exotic animals to come in and have those animals examined by the Department of Agriculture, looking at their living facilities and the way they're taken care of.
exactly what the bill was supposed to do. Unfortunately, the bill was not broadly publicized, and some people were left out. So basically what we say is, and what we ask for, is that those folks that did not get their animals permitted, we ask in our new bill, that in Senate Bill 1584, that we open up the permanent process for a period of time which will end December 31st, 2014. This will allow the state, the Department of Agriculture, to identify those future or those further folks that have animals which they own prior to 2010, January 1st, 2010, to come in and have them permitted, looked at by the state, and identified so that we know that these animals are taken care of. This is a good law. It does benefit Mr. Clark in Gladstone. He is a veteran. He has had this cat. He does have PTSD, and he's had this cat, as I said, for 16 years, and he uses this cat as a way to mitigate his PTSD. And I will, as you see in the documents I had passed out to you, you can see that the cat is very docile. It has been declawed, has never been a problem in the community. And I think that this would be a great opportunity to, A or one, allow this cat to live out its life naturally. Senator Roblin was very articulate in his comments to this bill. And I believe that it does a function that we need to do, and that is make certain that everyone knows about this bill and has the opportunity to come back in and be registered with their animals. That way, they don't have to live outside of the law and ever worry about being caught as Mr. Clark was. And I thank you for your time, and I would take any questions.
I just have a quick question for you, Senator. Someone, I think it was Senator Roblin, mentioned that he sat down and made some changes in what was originally envisioned.
Yes.
And that was all incorporated in the bill as introduced, right?
Right. The bill is introduced. We redefined service animal, and we found that federal government defines a service animal as a service dog or a service horse, and we felt that that was not the correct way to go. The bill was good in its context, and we felt that the best way to go in discussions with everyone at the meeting was that why don't we just open up the registration again, make sure we can bring everyone in and have these permits issued, and the Department of Agriculture will then know that there's we hope that there won't be anybody outstanding that'll have an animal that they have to live under the law.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Bates.
Two or three quick questions. And the statement here says, when it was recently discovered this law does not allow Mr. Brad to keep, how was it discovered? Who cares, personally?
Well, what happened was that there was a lady in Gladstone, where this gentleman now resides, that is not a close proximity neighbor, was turned in for dogs at large, and she turned the cat into the city, and the city ran up against this bill, and so they had to take action on it. And I went in and chatted with the folks at the city, because January 9th was the due date, and everyone realized that they were pressed by the state issue. And they voted 5-1 to allow an extension to see if we could, in fact, modify this and open this up for further permitting.
Question to the bill. Section 3 talks about the Section 1, which is the part of the section that Section 1 is what really does what you want to do here. The Act is repealed January 2nd of 2017. Is that what you want? The Section 1 is what outlines what you want done. It allows it to occur December 31st of 2014, and then down in Section 3, that whole section is repealed, but not until 2017. Did you mean that to be 2015? So you have that window for this to happen, then it goes away, or for some reason you're trying to keep it open for two more years?
Just if I could jump in, I think they have till December 31st of 2015, right? For the
2014 to register.
I may be reading this wrong. I've got December 31st, 2014, and they have the conditions for it. and then after December 31st, 2014, you can't go back and, if I'm reading it right, you can't go back and grandfather anything in. But then Section 3 is kind of funny. It says January 2nd, 2017. I don't know why. There's, it seemed like more likely the date would be 2015.
Yeah.
If I may be reading it wrong. I probably should talk to LC about it.
I think...
I may be reading it wrong. I'll check with the LC.
No, I think the intent was that the process takes some time. The Department of Ag has to go out and inspect the facilities, and if the process has started late, like in mid-December, that they have time to get the process done and get the permits issued, and then the act is over.
Okay, but the last time they can apply for that is December 31st.
December 31st, right.
And if I could follow up, in Section 2, then the Department of Agriculture has until December 31st of 2015 to issue or deny the permit. So I guess the question is that where the window closes? And if it closes there, why do we need two more years for the bill to sunset?
I'd have to ask LC on that one.
Yeah, okay. The dates just seem off to
right.
me.
Right.
So, last question. When you talked about this idea of a service animal is becoming an issue, okay, for physicians and other people, all kinds of issues are coming up about it with individuals wanting different types of animals as their service animal, some of which seem a little bizarre at times, to say the least. Did you have any discussion about what the state definition of a service animal is? I'm wondering, we've got two bills here that might be in conflict with one another.
Well, I'm not certain exactly on that. I do know that in Senate Bill 391, they actually described a service monkey. One would believe that if we follow the federal guidelines, the service animal is a dog or a horse.
That's the old agricultural
right.
definition.
Okay.
If you have this discussion, that's fine. I just wondered if you happen to.
Well, when I heard horse, I pictured, you know, the big ones, and I'm going, wow, be quite difficult to lead that horse around. But
yeah. we're going to have increasing difficulty with some other issues. Service pigs in restaurants, I mean, that kind of stuff is going to start popping up. It already has. Okay, so just thought I'd ask.
And I would follow up to that question. This really doesn't deal with the fact of service animals. What it does is that if you have an exotic animal that you had not permitted by January 1st, 2010, this allows you to come back in and do that.
Thanks. Why don't we hear from George? You can come,
I can
come back up. And
any more questions for me?
I don't think so.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George O'Coolidge, here on behalf of the Oregon Humane Society. We're not affiliated with any other local group or any national group. We're the largest animal welfare organization in the state, founded in 1868 with over 50,000 supporters around the state. My testimony is going to be rather brief today. You've heard the story of how the bill got here. We worked on the original Senate Bill 391 back in 2009. We're a big supporter of that. Obviously, that bill was meant to protect public safety and animal welfare. And we actually think this bill is actually an appropriate exemption to that original bill. This is an animal that has been with this individual for as long as the animal has lived. So we think it's the humane thing to do. We've had state veterinarian folks out checking this situation and think that it's, you know, the conditions are appropriate and humane. And you know, we had a number of folks that were disheartened to hear that if this bill didn't pass, that this individual would, instead of taking to a sanctuary, would probably euthanize the animal. And so we're here to support the bill and would be happy to answer any questions. I can sort of just on you know, Senator Bates, one of your questions. I think Oregon defines service animal as a dog and or as rules define. There was a bill last session that Senator Cruz sponsored and worked with the disability community and veterans to try to narrow the law down a little bit, but be consistent with the federal guidelines. And the idea behind the rules was to say if there are pigs and monkeys and things like that, that they could go through the rulemaking process.
What I was trying to get to there, I was wondering, under previous law, he was already actually protected as a companion animal, and that would protect him without even having the bill. But I don't know that. I'll ask Elsie.
Michael, would you call Katie?
Sure. Actually, we have somebody else who would like to testify. Katie. Thanks, George. And Katie, if you could give your name for the record and spell your last name, please.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, Katie Koba, COBA, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Just here to answer any questions. We worked with the legislators that convened the group to figure out the best way to handle this situation, and do believe that, in essence, we're opening up a window to allow the department to permit owners of exotic animals that had those animals before the initial bill was passed back in 2009. It's not an opportunity for someone who is bringing in a new exotic animal to get permitted. It really is to allow that window of opportunity. And we also believe that with this bill passing, there's enough media interest in this animal that it will allow a better chance to get the word out for those individuals out there who may have an exotic animal to come in and get it permitted legally, again, if they owned and can prove that they owned that animal prior to 2009.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So. Thank you very much for spending an afternoon with us. I really appreciate you staying, and I know your time is valuable, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're welcome. Maybe just to clarify, I'm not LC, and I think it's worth checking with LC, but at the end of the bill, it looks like it allows a window of opportunity for any judicial proceedings
right.
to go to 2017. So I think that's maybe why then the whole section would be repealed in 2017.
Makes sense. So the agency would have until the end of 2015 to make its determination. And then if there were an appeal of that, they'd have two more years.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I would hope that that would not happen, but apparently that's the way LC felt it need to be written.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may quote that, it's on page mm-hmm. 2, sub B, terminate any administrative or judicial proceeding pending on January 2, 2017 regarding State Department of Agriculture decision to issue or deny a permit under this section of this 2014 Act.
Thank you, Katie. Any final comments people might want to make about this bill, Senator Hess?
First, I would like to compliment Senator Olson for going to bat for one of his constituents. It's part of the job. We've all done that. And so take what I have to say with that delicate treatment and admiration of you doing your job. I think, you know, on a very basic level that if we have illegal activity in this state and we make an exception in the law for one person, that we're getting into dangerous territory, no matter how sympathetic that person may be. If you go back to 2009 and the reason that bill was passed, and it was a pretty major effort, I think anybody involved, was because there was a problem. And law enforcement was the force pushing this bill through, because people were coming home with dangerous bobcats or alligators and didn't know what to do with it. And what's a police officer in Beaverton supposed to do with an alligator? Take it to the zoo? No, they won't take it. Take it to jail? And these kinds of instances were popping up all over. And so that's why we had to pass this law, not to mention the humane treatment of some of these creatures. And I can tell you, these hearing rooms were filled with lots of parents who didn't like the idea of someone down the street or next door with some kind of an exotic animal who wasn't trained to keep it and didn't have the habitat to care for it. So while I'm sympathetic to Senator Olson and his constituent, and if I was certain that it was just helping that one situation, I'd feel differently. But when you create a loophole for one person, and that person is going to be a good player and it'll be fine, the problem is there are 40 other people who are willing to exploit a loophole in the law. And that's what worries me most about this particular concept. So I just wanted to make sure everyone knew where I stood on this idea.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes, certainly.
And I thank you for your concerns. It is a really good bill because I can't picture the police trying to handcuff an alligator. It just seems to be ridiculous. But the point is that it's not a bill for one person. Yes, one person is directly going to be affected by it, but it's a bill to encompass all of those in the state that did not get registered, that did not know about it. As I said, there was 919 new laws passed. When I hear a new law that I want to go into my tax account, he has to take courses to find out what laws we've passed to move forward and keeps us up to date on that. But on a bill such as this, on a law such as this, probably wasn't highly publicized. People didn't know about it. I know there could be 10, 15, 20 people that could take advantage of it and not live outside the law but live within the law. It allows the Department of Agriculture to go out to those people, inspect their facilities, make sure that their facilities are in good shape to protect the community, to protect the animal, to protect the health of the animal, and bring those people in and take them off the rolls of the lawless, and bring them to the side of the law. Now, this gentleman did not know about the law, lived in Milwaukee for 14 years. Not a soul in Milwaukee had a problem with it. It's when he moved to Gladstone to a bigger home, built this fine enclosure. It's a beautiful enclosure. Did he run into this law? And I understand your situation, and I understand what you're saying, that you don't like to write laws for individuals because sometimes it's not good. But, you know, I've been here for 3.5 years now, and I've seen we've written laws exclusively for individual corporations. And so it has been done. There is some justification. But what this does, it opens this registration up. It does not allow people to bring in animals past the deadline of January 1st, 2010. If you owned it prior to that and you're outside the law, you can now make yourself legal. And then Department of Ag will now have a thorough record of who those people are. And that's, I think, the important part, is the fact that we now know and can identify these people and the animals they have and make sure the animals are taken care of. In this case, this cat has been wonderfully taken care of, and you can see from the pictures how serene and playful it is. It's a good law, and it doesn't bend the rules. It just opens up the registration again. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other comments? Okay. With that, I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 1584 to Wednesday. Colleagues, I'll get you the amendments that we'll be considering on Wednesday as soon as we have them. Okay. With that, we are adjourned for the day.